Good Sunday morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Face Connecticut here on WTIC and WTIC-FM. Sam Gingerelli, your host for another program as we are in the middle of the month of August, August 14th. And we hope you're doing well where you are. And we hope we can help you out because we have an interesting topic to lead off the show. Going to be talking to a doctor from the UConn Health Center about sleep disorders, the various and sundry forms that you can disrupt your sleep and what happens when you do that. And none of it's good, believe me. Then later on in the program, it's kind of a kid's day. We'll be talking to someone from the Commission on Children who's going to be talking about the new anti-bullying law that will be in effect this coming fall when kids go back to school. But first of all, we have with us Dr. Jennifer Kanaan from the UConn Health Center, professor in medicine, and she's also a sleep expert, as they say. Jennifer, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Now, we've got a number of different sleep disorders. I guess we're going to start with the pediatric. And anybody who's had a baby knows that, sometimes their sleep can be kind of erratic.
That's right. Certainly, it takes a number of months for a baby's neurologic development to allow them to have less fragmented sleep. Mm-hmm. However, if you talk to a lot of new moms, one of the things they're really focused on is how to get their baby sleeping through the night. There are a number of different changes that happen throughout the child's lifetime, and we continue to notice changes in through adolescence and young adulthood, which often is perplexing for moms and dads.
Mm-hmm. Is there one main disorder, or is it just, as you said, the body system's getting sort of synced up, so to speak?
So when the baby is first born, neurologically, they still have a number of months to continue with neurologic mm-hmm. development before they really develop normal sleep stages. So in that initial time period, it's normal for an infant to have fragmented sleep, unfortunately. As the child gets older, so somewhere around 3-4 months, their sleep tends to become more consolidated. And one of the things that we found is certainly parent education is important in terms of understanding the number of naps that a young infant needs, which is really critical.
What is that, by the way?
So it depends on the age of the infant. When a child is first born, again, their sleep is very fragmented. Over the next several months, as it becomes more consolidated, they need upwards of 3 naps, so a morning nap, an afternoon nap, and then an evening nap.
Yeah.
Evening nap is the first nap that they drop, and then later on as they develop, they'll drop their morning nap.
Mm-hmm.
But as any parent will tell you, a child that has not had enough sleep is a cranky child.
Oh, yes. And you can always hear them. They'll let you know. They don't speak, but they do have auditory function.
They do. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got my next-door neighbor just had a baby, and she's pretty good. Her name is Maureen. She's very good. But there are times when there'll be some crying. Hey, what do you tell folks to look for just in case things may not be going so well with a child? Because, you know, the kid's not going to be able to tell you, Mommy, something's wrong at that point.
That's a great point. So one of the things we look for in early childhood is the presence of snoring. Snoring for young children is not normal and should be brought to the attention of your pediatrician. Oftentimes, it's a signal that something more serious is going on, such as pediatric sleep apnea. That tends to peak at around ages 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
And there's oftentimes a simple cure. Simply taking out the tonsils often is curative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had mine removed, but not as a child, a little bit later on. Tonsils and adenoids, I remember that. Because
that's right.
They were walking me out, and I just blacked out, so they had to wheel me out in a wheelchair. But anyway, enough about me. Now, is there anything else that moms and dads should be sort of on the lookout for with babies and their sleep patterns and so forth?
Certainly one of the things I think that's important for a parent to know is how much sleep should a child obtain every night. So as a young infant, they spend a great deal of their life sleeping. Elementary school kids need upwards of 10 hours. And our young adolescents need between 9 and 9.5 hours of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So your teenager that's grumpy...
Yeah.
Oftentimes is not getting enough sleep.
Aren't teenagers always grumpy, though? How do
no
you
comment.
Tell? Yeah, exactly.
But But this can have really long-term consequences. So insufficient sleep in the teenagers has been tied to driving accidents and has been actually tied to obesity and suicidal ideation. So children who are at risk for suicide, oftentimes we find in retrospect have had insufficient sleep. So that's very important for parents to be aware of.
Now, does the insufficient sleep lead to cognitive a sort of depression, or does it go right to the suicidal ideation?
So that's a great point. Insufficient sleep has been linked to a number of things, including an increased risk of depression, anxiety, increased suicidal tendencies, and then academic performance and social interactions.
Yeah, that leads me to my next point. I hear you're a big proponent of delaying the start of school, and that's been a topic that's been out there and out there and has been discussed, and it's one of those things that people never seem to get around to actually doing something about.
Right. I think it's been a point that nationwide sleep societies have tried to address on both a national level and a regional level. From a biological standpoint, the adolescent brain tends to go to bed later. So they release melatonin later. They tend to have sleep latency later. So compared to elementary school children, they tend to want to go to bed later.
Yeah.
Having said that, they still need between 9 and 9.5 hours of sleep.
Right.
And with our current school start times, it's incredibly challenging to get 9 hours of sleep and get to school on time.
Hmm. And therefore, move the start times back.
Therefore, it probably would be in everybody's best interest, including the students and the school system, to have a delayed school start time. So to have the elementary schools conceivably start school at an earlier time, and the high school students start perhaps a little bit later.
Yeah.
It's been shown in numerous studies to improve academic performance. Again, the long-term consequences of decreased car fatalities in the adolescent population, decreased truancy, improved social interactions, improved parent-teacher and student interactions. So it really has far-reaching consequences.
Yeah, so it's not just I want to watch Dave Letterman tonight. That's not it. The actual physiological, the melatonin doesn't really get released until later on, huh?
That's correct for adolescents.
Now, the other thing, I guess the Journal of the American Medical Association recently put out a new, I don't know if you want to call it a warning, but a new study about sleep apnea in women with some interesting results. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So this was an article that was recently released in August out of JAMA, one of the premier medical journals. And what it showed is that women who have sleep-disordered breathing, so what I mean by that is when they go to bed at night and they fall asleep, they have apneic events, meaning that the airway relaxes too much and temporarily closes off.
Right.
As a result of this, their oxygen levels decrease, and that decrease in oxygen and fragmentation of sleep and cessation of airflow can all have dire long-term consequences. This particular article points to cognitive decline. So what they found was there was a link between sleep-disordered breathing, mild cognitive impairment, and dementia in older women.
Yeah. Now, does it just come in for older women, or is this sort of a collective thing where it sort of builds up?
So with sleep apnea, we know that in part it depends on the severity of sleep apnea. Certainly severe sleep apnea has been linked to an increased risk of high blood pressure, heart disease, strokes, as well as cognitive impairment.
Yeah.
It certainly is a spectrum, so some people with mild sleep disorder breathing are less at risk. This article is very interesting because it really points to the female population.
Yeah. Why is it? Why is there a difference? Is there a difference in the physiology or what's going on in the body when the airflow gets cut off, or
so
do we know?
Usually women who are premenopausal have less of a risk of sleep-disordered breathing. As your estrogen production goes down, you lose that protective effect. And I believe that's why they structured the study as such, to talk about older women and the risk of sleep-disordered breathing.
Right. Now, If you're an older woman, chances are, because a lot of older women do not have partners, many of them are widows, how do you know when you're suffering from sleep apnea? Because you're asleep. And is there a cognitive recognition there that, oops, I just woke up again? Or And how would I know if I'm suffering from this?
That's a challenging question to answer. So as part of our screening tools, we'll ask our patients, have you ever stopped breathing, woken up short of breath in the middle of the night? Has anybody remarked to you that you're a loud snorer? So in other words, someone in another room has heard you snore or watched you fall asleep on the couch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Additional concerns are excessive daytime fatigue during the day, falling asleep at inappropriate times while driving, in a meeting, in a movie theater.
Yeah.
Other things to look for are unexplained headaches. So all these things may suggest to you that you're at risk for sleep apnea, and this is something you should discuss either with your sleep specialist or your primary care provider.
Mm-hmm.
Our primary care providers are very well educated in the field of sleep apnea and do a very good job in terms of referring the appropriate people to sleep specialists, such as myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know there are a number of ways to treat the apnea, and we were talking about some of them. Why don't we go into some of them that that are out there that are popular right now and effective, let's put it that way.
So the most common way that we treat sleep-disordered breathing is with what's called a CPAP machine. So CPAP stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure. And it's actually very similar to the masks that you see fighter pilots use when they go up in unpressurized aircraft. And it forces air in and it stents open the airway. It prevents you from having sleep-disordered breathing.
Mm-hmm.
We always recommend that our overweight patients lose weight. Some people, if they lose weight in the right area, completely resolve their sleep apnea.
All right.
Additional devices include a dental device. For some patients, that is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And surgical options exist as well for some patients.
We're out of time for this segment of the program, but we'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Jennifer Kanaan from the UConn Health Center.
Thank you.